This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Matt Longjohn emerged from a field of four Democrats to win his party's nomination in the 6th Congressional District, and now he is challenging longtime Republican Congressman Fred Upton in the general election. Matt Longjohn, thank you very much for being here.
Gordon, thank you for having me back.
So tell us once again about yourself and what you would like to do if you do get elected to Congress.
Sure. I'm a fifth-generation member of this community. Coming from a farming family, a military family, a working class family. My dad was a janitor. My mom was a teacher when I was young. And I went on to medical school, became not just a doc, but a public health guy. And in fact, I've had a non-traditional career. I don't see patients with stethoscopes and things like that. I've been working on community health and community health research and innovating new ways to lower healthcare costs, improve people's healthcare, improve people's quality of life. For the work that I did as the first ever national health officer for all the YMCAs in the country, I was named one of the top 100 innovators in healthcare in America. And I was convinced to run against Congressman Upton for this seat, the 6th District in Michigan, because I became convinced that you couldn't live your healthiest possible life if Congressman Upton continued in Congress. He's already been there 32 years, and we need new leadership.
So there's been a lot of talk about access to health care in this campaign, as well as others. What about that other part of it, though, that you just mentioned there, reducing health care costs? What is the way to bend the cost curve down at this point?
Yeah, that's what I am known for nationally, working on healthcare innovation, is actually improving the quality of care while reducing disease and disease burden and saving money. My team was the first team in the history of the United States to create a community jobs program that focused on preventing illness, specifically preventing diabetes. We were able to, through a community health worker jobs program, prevent between 58 and 71% of new cases of diabetes, which, no surprise, resulted in a huge cost savings to Medicare, a 5-to-1 return on investment for Medicare. So when we talk about bending the healthcare cost curve, it's by getting upstream, by unlocking the value of community in our healthcare system, and connecting people to preventive services to avoid costly diseases before they ever get started.
What does that look like in public policy terms?
It's great. So first of all, you cannot cut coverage in insurance plans for essential health benefits, which often includes screening exams, mammographies, blood testing for glucose, for diabetes, et cetera. You know, people talk about the concern we all had when Congressman Upton wrote the Upton Amendment and helped move the Republican health care plan forward last year to cut coverage for pre-existing conditions and essential health benefits. It wasn't just coverage of ambulance rides to emergency rooms. That was troubling enough. But it was also going to cut things that would help us save money, like preventive services, like helping people get into preventive services at the lowest cost and earliest opportunity to avoid costly diseases up front. Medicare spends about $1 trillion a year, and 40% of that goes to the treatment of healthcare concerns for people with diabetes. If we can prevent 58 to 71% of new cases of diabetes by creating community health worker jobs and preventing diabetes in the first place, that's the kind of policy that we need to be focused on, not new drug therapy for people after they've already been ill.
Let me ask you about another health-related concern, which has hit close to home here in the Kalamazoo area, PFOSes. And safe drinking water. What's the federal government's responsibility for making sure that we are able to turn our tap on and drink the water with confidence that it's not going to make us sick?
The federal government is the guarantor of our rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And if you can't drink your water, the chances are you're not only going to have a hard time living a healthy, high-quality life, but that you're going to have real impact on your ability to go through your daily routine. The federal EPA has been remiss in a couple different ways, and I'll talk about that. But as a public health individual, as someone who has a master's in public health, I've been talking about environmental health, working on environmental health for nearly 20 years. And what I know is that the science is evolving, but that we have to take an aggressive stance to help people live their healthiest lives, to keep clean water safe. That's why I've been endorsed by groups like Clean Water Action, the Sierra Club, League of Conservation Voters, because of my record on environmental health. Congressman Upton actually has voted to repeal things like the Clean Water Rule and other things like that, not been a consistent voice for things that we need to have environment be safe and healthy. PFAS has right now a lifetime safety limit of about 70 parts per trillion. But the data suggests that maybe it should be 13 or 15. And when we don't have the best possible data and we just have the best available data, we have to err on the side of safety. We have to make sure that the corporate interests who are fighting to keep the level of safety at 70 parts per trillion, who want to have privatized profits but socialized costs of cleanup, are not the ones that are dictating what the safety level is and advocating in the halls of Congress to bury certain reports or keep the EPA from pushing out new safety limits. The EPA needs to have a clear science agenda around PFAS, PFOS. You know, there's about 1,000 polyfluoral alkyl substances, and we only test for 50. So we need to expand that and give money to states to have a stronger regimen of testing, surveillance, monitoring, and improvement.
So more broadly, what does the data tell us, and what are the best practices when it comes to addressing climate change?
Well, I believe the science is clear that the climate is changing and that human behavior has a significant role in that. And I'm not talking about one study or a different study. I like to look at studies of studies. I like to look at meta-analyses, where you put 1,000 studies together. And you say, you know, here are the criteria that we're looking for. What is the answer? And it's, again, not going to be because it's science. It never tells you the answer is X. It tells you the answer is not Y. That's what science is. You can't prove that null hypothesis. You have to disprove it. And right now, the science shows that it is so likely that human-caused climate change is the most significant factor facing my kids' generation, our grandkids' generation, that we must act now. That there's a fraction of a chance that that's not the case. And if we do nothing, we risk everything. So, what I want to make sure is that we don't only go back to strengthening air quality standards like CAFE standards for mileage requirements for cars for clean air. I don't want to just make sure that we strengthen our water safety programs like testing for PFAS and making sure our Great Lakes are protected. But I also want to make sure that we have agri-innovation to make sure that our soil and the resources of this district are also protected as a part of our environmental strategies. Ultimately, in Southwest Michigan, we need to recognize that our environment is our economy, whether it's a recreation economy where people are enjoying our lakes as tourists, or whether it's in the agricultural economy. We have to protect our environment. And again, Congressman Fred Upton's record on the environment is dismal. He used to be a climate change believer, and now he's a climate change denier. Coincidentally, that happened as he took the chair of the Energy and Commerce Committee and started cashing in millions of bucks from big oil, big gas industries. And I believe that he hasn't done enough to protect our environment. He has an 11 to 13% voting record on the environment. I believe you can't live your healthiest possible life without addressing environmental health and making sure everyone has clean air, water, and soil in this district.
Regarding the economy, the unemployment rate is low right now. The stock market is up. Why should voters feel that it's necessary to make any big change to economic policy?
It's not an equitable distribution. When you talk about the stock market being up, you know, only 50% of people in the country own any stock. So the economy might be doing well for folks who have always done well. But because of new tax policy, because of 30 years of tax policy, most recently the December tax bill that was passed as well, the trickle-down economic theory that we've been following is consistently giving more and more advantage to fewer and fewer people, and more people are working harder to make ends meet. Those are the folks that don't own stock. Those are the folks that are not participating in the economic recovery. And not all jobs are created equal. When you talk about the unemployment rate being low, many of those jobs don't have wages that cover the basic necessities of life. We've had wage stagnation for 30 years in Southwest Michigan, coincidentally the amount of time that Congressman Upton's been in Congress. And we have not seen people's quality of life or ability to plan for a dignified retirement or their kids' education become any easier. we need to make sure that we aren't just taking care of the 1% in the corporate folks and planning on trickle-down economics working for us in the future, but we got to fight for people's basic needs to be met through a minimum wage of $15 an hour, can't leave the tipped employees behind, and we also have to make sure that the benefits that go along with wages for health insurance, et cetera, are also added onto that so that people can meet their basic minimum daily needs.
Can you give me a broad sense of how you would want to structure the tax code? And understanding that even if you're elected to Congress, you're going to be one member of 435 in the House, and you don't get to decide these things unilaterally.
Correct.
But do you think we need more tax brackets? And do you have a number that you would say set for like the highest percentage that people should, the highest marginal rate that people should be paying on income?
So, you know, the tax brackets that we have had in place since December, really, you know, they were supposed to be simplified and they weren't. Just the percentages were changed around. You know, the biggest focus of the tax policy change in December was on the corporate tax rate. And I think that you could see a legitimate argument for having reduced the corporate tax rate. I was not opposed to reducing the corporate tax rate. What I was opposed to, and what I remain opposed to, and what I would work on in terms of tax policy, is making sure that because we just gave this huge kickback, essentially, to corporate America by reducing those corporate tax rates, that we also have to go back in and do what was promised. Close the tax loopholes that exist, the subsidies and the ways that corporations can get around paying any tax, to make sure that even though we've reduced the corporate tax rate, that it's an effective tax rate. Right now and in the past, whatever the corporate rate was, because people have great accounting techniques and great professional accountants, they're not paying the effective tax rate. And so I want to go back in and make sure that we close those corporate tax loopholes for big oil, big gas, and other cash-rich industries that didn't need all of what we gave them and certainly can pay their fair share by closing those corporate loopholes. That would go a long way to keeping my kids from having a new $1.5 trillion of debt added on to their future, which is what we did, what Congressman Upton did as part of the conference committee, one of the last nine members of Congress to help shape that tax bill. So, you know, I would go back. Again, I would not change necessarily the corporate tax rate. I think that we did need to give a shot in the arm to corporate America, but we should make sure that they are playing by the same rules and close up those loopholes, make sure that those monies that we can claw back are put back into education and healthcare and job training programs and things that we need to live our healthiest possible lives.
How about on individual rates? Do you think where they're set right now is about right?
I think that there are a number of things on the tax scam bill that was passed in December that, again, I didn't have problems with. And we're talking about changes of a couple percentage points here and there. And ultimately, I think that what my biggest problem with is the philosophy of the idea that, you know, you give the greatest tax cuts to those who are doing the best and plan on them through philanthropic endeavors or et cetera, taking care of everyone else. These mythological job creators, right, are going to help everyone if you just give them a little bit more cash in their pocket. It turns out that you know, Betsy DeVos or others will just buy more yachts instead of helping out their fellow man. So, you know, I think the philosophy has to be that we have to put the middle class forward first, and that means lower rates for people with lower income. But it also means that we don't tax their expenditures for workplace expenditures, for example. You know, there were proposals to take the deductions away from teachers who were buying classroom supplies. You know, and we give deductions to offices that buy pens, but we weren't going to give deductions to teachers who buy crayons. We need a more person and community-focused tax code. And I think that even within the tax structure that we have with the percentages on different income rates, that the letter of the law and the regulation of the tax code can be used to put people forward better than we are doing.
How do you ensure, from the federal government's standpoint here, that a high-quality education is available broadly throughout the country to everybody who's in K-12?
Well, I believe, first of all, coming from a family of teachers, that our education system is, like labor laws, et cetera, a great way for us to ensure there is a path to the middle class in an equitable way for people of all zip codes, all denominations, all ethnicities, et cetera, to achieve equity in our society. And so I believe that we have to be funding our public education system to a much greater extent than we have been. We are not using our values when we're creating our budget. We're putting way too many dollars into ineffective Department of Defense programs and things like that we could be putting more into education. I believe that a priority has to be early childhood education. As a preventionist, I know that prevention works better than treatment, and I know that early prevention works best. We're not only, if we fund early childhood education, helping to make sure that kids graduate at higher percentages, but we're also plugging kids into systems of care and support that they may need throughout their early childhood and give them a chance to have a great career as well. The evidence is very clear that early childhood programs work great.
So you think that the federal government should be pumping money into early childhood, pre-K,
yes,
those sort of programs, specifically ones which are public and available to, you know, people of all incomes, that sort of thing?
Yes, absolutely. And I also think that we can't let our federal education policy dilute our investment in public education by diverting funds or allowing the diversion of funds to for-profit entities like education management organizations, the kinds of things that Secretary DeVos has been pushing, where for-profit entities who have a different incentive than public educators or public education administrators. You know, people who are working hard to help kids in our public schools have a different incentive than those who are trying to provide shareholder value or profit motives to their investors. I don't think that taxpayer money should go into those kinds of for-profit charter schools or education management organizations that are siphoning resources out of our schools. If we shut that down and make sure that we invest in early childhood education, I think we'll be on a much better path.
On immigration, do you favor eliminating the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Office, also known as ICE?
I think that we have reached a point where we are going to have to shut it down and reconstitute it. There's no doubt that in the federal government's authority that something like ICE, something that manages our customs, something that does provide backup to the security on our border is within the purview of the federal government to have, and that it is a requirement for our sovereignty, et cetera, that we have an agency like that. But I believe that whether you're thinking about sanctuary cities, sanctuary states, or even the human rights violations that we've seen on the border this year, or the criminalization of refugees and the separation of families, that the entity known as ICE has essentially caused a lack of faith, a lack of trust in mayors and in governors and in sheriffs and in attorneys general. And I think that no matter what we call whatever agency works on our borders, it can't be known as ICE, and it's going to have to be reconstituted with policy that prevents any future zero tolerance regulations.
Do you think that the federal government should continue providing whatever funding they provide to sanctuary cities and states, or should they withhold it until cities and states drop the sanctuary status?
I agree with the courts, which have said that withholding resources from cities and states because of their sanctuary immigration policy, sanctuary city or state immigration policy, is unconstitutional.
More broadly on immigration policy, what are the right ways to have people come into this country legally? Should we be increasing or decreasing the avenues available for legal immigration? How much should we be putting in to security?
Yeah, I think that Congress had a really good approach going in 2013. There was a bipartisan comprehensive immigration policy that was drafted. It passed the Senate with a supermajority. It dealt with national security. It dealt with refugee status. It dealt with the Dreamers, the DACA program, et cetera, making pathways to citizenship permanent, and also recognizing that our economy needs more immigration to be able to support things like the Social Security program that we have. You know, right now we have too few workers to support the Social Security program. And so bringing people in through legal pathways was a part of that policy prescription in 2013. The only reason why we don't have that in place now is because House Republicans in 2013, 2014 did not want to give a victory to the Obama administration. You know, again, Congressman Upton is one of the five longest-serving members of the Republican House. He's been voting along party lines, not along the policies that he talks about, for at least 8 years. He has a 98-99% voting record with Speaker Ryan or the Trump administration most recently. And so, you know, when we talk about immigration policy, we only need to look back at what we could have had in 2013, tinker with it a little bit to make sure that the new zero-tolerance programs that were attempted this year cannot be implemented. Because they were human rights violations, and then go from there. You know, the Trump administration just in the last couple of days has reduced the refugee cap to 30,000 people per year. And I don't know what the right number is. I think that there are folks in those policy think tanks who would have a better sense of the number. But I think we're going in the wrong direction.
You mentioned being from a military family. When do you think the bar is met or is crossed where the United States should authorize military force in another country?
Well, the only authorization of the use of military force that we have in place right now, it goes back to immediately post 9/11. And, you know, what was written in 2001 for the authorization of the use of military force was very broad. And we've used as a nation that that authorization language to basically fight a global war on terror that has, since the invasion of Iraq, since the invasion of Afghanistan, you know, 17 years of unending conflict. And we've seen now deaths in Nigeria. We've seen service women and men put at risk in places where even members of Congress were surprised to hear we had people stationed or doing special operations. And I think it is absolutely time that we go back and revise the authorization of military force, AUMF, and make sure that Congress does its job to protect our women and men in the military by not allowing the executive, the president, and the administration to have just unfettered, whimsical ideas of where they need to be putting defense assets. That has to be on the books. We need to know where we're sending our service women and men. We need to make sure the mission is clear so that they're not put in harm's way with an ability to, when things go wrong, sweep it under the rug. Congress needs to do its job. And again, I think that this is a place where the current Congress has been faulted.
On your website, at one point, one of the categories is standing up to Trump. And quoted in here, it says that Matt has spent 20 years building coalitions built on trust and shared values. If you are elected to the United States House, it is possible that Republicans may still have control, and probably a little more likely they would still have control of the Senate. Regardless of what happens there, there will be a Republican president, and most likely it will still be President Trump. So can you build coalitions with President Trump if you are in Congress representing the 6th District?
Yeah, I think that you can, but I don't think that Trump is the negotiating power that a member of Congress is likely to be dealing with. I think it's going to be more colleagues across the aisle or within the same party who have shared interests. And what you know, you see, whether it's in terms of the budgeting process, where the Trump administration consistently tries to zero out things that Congress knows we shouldn't be zeroing out, and then they come back and put more money back into these programs, that the negotiation that's really happening is between the executive and the legislative branches. Within the legislative branch, I believe that there is a tremendous opportunity and that there will be an even greater opportunity after November to create the kind of coalitions that can put people-centered policies first and provide a resistance to President Trump's agenda when it is, as has been the case in a number of cases, a number of issues, not rooted in law. You know, it was a violation of human rights, what happened at the border. You know, we should, in the authorization of military force, just the last two questions you asked me, the legislative branch needs to step up and do its job, which constitutionally is to provide a check and balance to the executive. When the executive is wrong or not following the best interests of the people in this district, I'll be standing up. And I believe that there will be people from across the country doing so as well.
Why do you think that there's a greater opportunity after the November election for people in Congress to find common ground? Because there hasn't been a whole lot of that, for a number of years, frankly, in Congress and in the House or Senate.
I am incredibly encouraged by what I'm seeing across the country in these midterm elections. You know, every one of the 435 House seats comes up for election every 2 years. And the kinds of changes that we're seeing in this district, across the state of Michigan, and across the country, give me the idea that we're going to have a different kind of Congress moving forward in 2019 and 2020. Whether we see the control of the House flip or not, we are seeing more women, more people of color, more people who are outsiders to the political process jump in, like myself, who have an idea of evidence-based policy as being what we need to be moving forward with and not hyper-partisanship. I think we need a new generation of leaders on both sides of the aisle. I think that 32 years is too long for Mr. Upton to have represented this district without being tied down with strings that are making him vote in ways that aren't in line with the interests of families all over this district. But I also think that folks like Nancy Pelosi have been leaders of the Democratic Party for too long. I have said and will say again that, you know, I won't support Nancy Pelosi for Speaker of the House if the Democrats win control. We need a new generation of leadership on both sides of the aisle to get things done. And I think that we're going to be in a better place to see that happen in response to President Trump's administration.
Is there someone you have in mind that you would support for Speaker of the House?
I don't know who's running yet, you know, and quite frankly, as I'm running around here in this district, my focus is more on meeting new people, making sure that we build on the energy that we had in the primary. There was a 300% increase in voter turnout in August compared to the last midterm primary. And we still have work to do to make sure that we capture that energy and put it forward into a win in November.
You released the results of a poll, which showed you 5 points down, depending on how you figure this out. If you count in the U.S. Taxpayers Party candidate, then it changes a little bit. Just to understand a little bit about this poll, this is a poll that your campaign commissioned?
Yes. The poll that that you're referencing was conducted by a organization called the Global Strategies Group. They're a recognized and reputable polling organization that we hired to do polling, not just to say in a horse race, how are we doing, but to help us understand the needs of folks in this district. That poll was the one that we commissioned. Being a social scientist, you know, I had lots of questions about methods. I've never been involved in that kind of thing before, learned a lot. The margin of error was 4.4%. So when people talk about the top line, you know, being 5 percentage points behind Fred, that's the top line. But being a scientist, the 4.4 margin of error gives you a better idea of the range in which we are. What was interesting to me about that poll, most interesting to me about the poll, wasn't where we stood in a horse race. It was that Congressman Upton has an 84-85% name ID. And that I have a 30% name ID, and that as a first-time candidate, unknown to 70% of people in this district, I'm arguably within 5 points of a 32-year incumbent. Again, that speaks to just the moment that we're in. There were two other polls done within 2 weeks of that poll. One showed that we were 4 points down. One showed that we were 6 points down. So the poll that we commissioned was in range with those other results. And I do believe that's what led to us being identified last week as a red to blue race, meaning a top tier race in the country. People are astonished that folks like 32-year incumbent Fred Upton are on the hot seat. And this is a race that we can win.
I will say that there have been polls which have come out, I think the last two or three election cycles, which have showed this was a winnable race for Democrats. Why do you think it would be more winnable in 2018 than it was in 16, 14, et cetera?
Well, I believe that Congressman Upton's votes on health care and on the tax bill in particular, and his support of the Republican Party over the interests of people in this district, has been crystallized in the last couple of years. I think that is one of the reasons why it's a different cycle. You know, it was the Upton Amendment. It wasn't just a vote he took on someone else's bill. I mean, it was his amendment. his namesake amendment, written on the Resolute desk in the Oval Office, that would have waived coverage for pre-existing conditions and essential health benefits for a token political gesture of support for high-risk insurance categories. He was willing to sell people down the river. And even though it didn't happen, even though Senator McCain put his thumbs down dramatically at 1 a.m., you know, months later, the Upton Amendment showed where Congressman Upton's heart was at. And I think that folks are frustrated by that. And the tax bill, when combined with the tariffs that we're seeing, I think is just showing people that, again, this idea that trickle-down economics defending corporate interests is not what we need for people in this district.
Matt Longjohn is the Democratic candidate for Congress in Michigan's 6th Congressional District. He is challenging Republican Congressman Fred Upton in the general election in November. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Gordon.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.